Lawmakers approve a bill allowing VPSOs to carry firearms.
This does not mandate that they have to, but it does allow them to go ahead and lift that restriction that has been there by the Department of Public Safety from the past.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, advocating for more trails in Alaska's largest city.
It can be a very tough nut to get somebody to understand that a trail in close proximity to their home is a benefit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Governor Sean Parnell's $150 million bill to subsidize Alaska's oil refineries grew to $200 million today when House Speaker Mike Chenault expanded it to include the Agrium fertilizer plant in Nikiski. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The plant has been closed for years, but Agrium said last year it's considering reopening it. Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, says he's been talking to the company for a while about some kind of state incentive. Then, a few days ago, the governor proposed a bill to help refineries. Chenault says Agrium recognized the possibility.
Well, we've been looking, and this happens to be a vehicle, and I did bring it up and said, hey, could we qualify for this? So we investigated it and drafted up the amendment.
Chenault says bringing the plant online could create 450 jobs in his district, plus cheap fertilizer for Mat-Su farmers. House Bill 287 would provide a refinery up to $10 million a year in tax credits or cash for 5 years. To qualify, a company would have to spend $25 million on its infrastructure. The Parnell administration proposed it to help PetroStar cope with the high price of North Slope crude. Senator Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat, says she's angry this bill is moving while funding for education remains uncertain.
It galls me. It seems like the legislature's never met a tax incentive or a tax credit we didn't endorse if it's for the oil industry.
It's as if, she says, industry gets what it wants and kids get the crumbs. Chenault dismissed such comparisons, saying that's just the Democratic mantra. The bill cleared the House Rules Committee in about 6 minutes this morning and heads next to the House floor. In Juneau, I'm Liz Ruskin.
At $245 million, the biggest item in the capital budget before the legislature is a power plant for the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. The project is now before the House Finance Committee for review, and lawmakers are less surprised by the price tag than how the funding package works in the first place. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Because Alaska is in deficit spending mode, the legislature is less inclined to sign massive checks outright. So if you want a mega project funded, you can ask for a trickle of grants spread out over a few years. Or you can fund it creatively. The second approach is being taken with the University of Alaska Fairbanks power plant, and lawmakers like Representative Lindsay Holmes wrestled with the concept on Tuesday night.
I'm just trying to get a handle on who's paying where and to what extent the moral obligation or actual obligation of the state's involved and who's on first. Since we got four different funding sources kind of all weaving together.
There's a good reason why she was lost, but let's try to break it down. The first chunk of money is straight cash that some senators had originally wanted to use to finish UAF's engineering building. Then comes a reappropriation, with the legislature draining an energy loan program to help pay for the plant. Revenue bonds make the third pot of money, with the university slated to pay that back through energy savings and by potentially passing the cost on to students. Last but not least is the biggest source of money, nearly $90 million from the Municipal Bond Bank Authority, which has in the past only sold bonds for Alaska's cities. That's probably the most complicated part of the arrangement, because even though the bonds are for the university system, the state will be paying off that debt on their behalf, to the tune of $6 million a year. Even Kevin Mitchell, who directs the bond bank, struggled to explain who will actually be responsible for paying that off.
The state is going to maybe, through the back door, but not from our perspective. The commitments that we're going to get are going to be from the university.
The patchwork nature of the deal left members of the House Finance Committee with plenty of questions. Like, why wasn't the state just paying for this up front, instead of increasing the cost of the project by basically taking on debt? Representative Tammy Wilson, a North Pole Republican, wanted to know if UAF students were at risk of shouldering the burden through either increased tuition or fuel surcharges.
I guess that's what I don't understand. To me, maintenance, it shouldn't matter if it's on UAA, UAF, or UAS, or even one of the smaller campuses. So, and I don't know how your books work. So if I understand you correctly, though, that University of Alaska Fairbanks would be keeping like their own books, UAA would have their own accounting books, and each smaller one, and then that's how everything gets funded versus your one system that takes care of it as a system.
UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers responded that deciding whether the whole system or just the Fairbanks campus would cover the costs would be left to the Board of Regents. Committee members also wanted answers on why the project was so urgent. Rogers explained that unless the university upgrades their coal-powered plant, the campus was at risk of a major failure that would leave all of its buildings without power or heat. It's their top priority, and Fairbanks Republican Pete Kelly fought hard for the package in the Senate, winning out over the reservations of some of his colleagues. With all the confusion surrounding the project, Finance Co-Chair Bill Stoltz decided not to advance the package straight away, and instead let members, including himself, digest it.
I'm trying to come up with some an understanding, because this is, and I usually when there's, usually folks aren't speechless.
The committee is expected to amend the deal in coming days. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has accused the University of Alaska Fairbanks of possible Animal Welfare Act violations in the starvation deaths of 12 musk oxen at its large animal research station. USDA spokeswoman Tanya Espinoza said today an administrative judge will decide whether the university will face fines. An animal rights group hopes total $10,000 for each animal. University spokeswoman Miriam Grimes says the school is working on a response to the complaint. The USDA says the university failed to provide adequate veterinary care, identify that musk oxen were losing weight, or enlist veterinary treatment. The animals died or were euthanized in 2010 and 11. The complaint filed in late March follows a request by the group Stop Animal Exploitation Now to investigate the school. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Bethel woman who will compete for the title of Miss Indian World.
I'm still beading and sewing some of the last of my regalia. You know, I made myself an Athabascan dress.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Village public safety officers will soon be able to carry firearms if Governor Sean Parnell signs a measure approved this morning in the Senate. Senator Donnie Olson spoke on the bill's behalf.
House Bill 199 clearly establishes the legislature's intent to go ahead and allow those VPSOs in the various villages to carry firearms. This does not mandate that they have to, but it does allow them to go ahead and lift that restriction that has been there by the Department of Public Safety from the past.
Under HB 199, regional nonprofits have the final say in whether or not they want VPSOs to carry weapons. Some nonprofits, like the Tanana Chiefs Conference, sent letters urging legislators to support the measure. The bill allows up to 20 qualified VPSOs a year to travel to the Police Academy in Sitka for comprehensive firearms training, as well as use of deadly force instruction. The Department of Public Safety will absorb the $62,000 a year costs. The measure comes in the context of rising rates of rural violence and debates throughout the state on how to improve public safety in communities off the road system. Violence claimed the life of a village public safety officer last year.
We all remember that sad day on March 19, 2013, when the unarmed VPSO Thomas Madal in Manicotic got into the line of fire. This is a response to that, so that with proper training, they will be able to go ahead and be armed.
HB 199 was approved on the Senate floor unanimously. It now heads to the governor's desk for his signature. The Alaska House of Representatives today approved a bill that would symbolically recognize 20 Alaska Native languages as official state languages. House Bill 216 passed on a 38-0 vote. With less than a week to go in this year's legislative session, the Senate State Affairs Committee will hear the bill tomorrow. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Supporters clapped from the gallery as lawmakers pounded their desks in approval after House Speaker Mike Chenault announced the bill had passed.
Committee substitute for House Bill 216, State Affairs, has passed the House.
Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins, HB 216's prime sponsor, said in a House floor speech that even if the bill is largely symbolic, it's still important to honor Native languages.
EAC is one of the languages recognized in this bill. The last fluent speaker of EAC passed away 5 short years ago. There are several other languages that are on the brink, have just a handful of fluent speakers left in Alaska.
Christ Tompkins said he hopes to someday learn Tlingit, one of 3 indigenous languages in southeast Alaska. Representative Charisse Millett, an Anchorage Republican and co-sponsor of the legislation, said her only regret in life is that she never asked her Inupiaq grandmother to teach her the language.
She told me stories of fish camps and told me stories of moving from town to town to live a subsistence lifestyle, picking berries, but I never learned the language.
Millett said she hopes recognizing the state's original languages will empower young people to overcome the shame her grandmother and mother felt about being Alaska Native.
To engage in conversation, learn the language that their heritage of their elders, learn the stories of what Alaska was, so they know how to make Alaska a better place.
The legislature's only fluent speaker of an Alaska Native language is Representative Benjamin Nagiak, a Barrow Democrat, who delivered about half of his remarks in Inupiaq.
Una, House Bill 216. Kwaranyak takput, akoktoniak takput, akoktok kugoloiki lipsignun.
Nagiak said the bill acknowledges indigenous languages have been spoken in Alaska since before European contact.
Most of our languages are still alive, and we need to continue to do to make sure that those languages thrive and survive.
After some Republicans on the House State Affairs Committee received HB 216 skeptically last month, a section was added to clarify that it does not require governments to conduct business in languages other than English, currently the only official state language. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Bethel resident Megan Leary is headed to Albuquerque, New Mexico later this month to vie for the title of Miss Indian World. The former Miss Chimay is preparing and raising money for her trip. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Each contestant competes in 5 areas: public speaking, personal interview, traditional presentation, dance, and essay. Leary says she's excited to represent Alaska.
There'll be girls from all across the nation and Canada and Mexico, different indigenous girls, young ladies my age, that'll be going and competing. They'll be showcasing their culture, their traditions, and their background, where they're from, and their talent, and just their knowledge of who we are as indigenous people.
Leary grew up in Kalskag in the Paiute and graduated from Bethel Regional High School. She was Miss Chimay 2013 and went on to become Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or Miss WIO. She says she's putting the finishing touches on her regalia.
I'm still beading and sewing some of the last of my regalia. You know, I made myself an Athabascan dress. I beaded for that, and I'm making a pair of Athabascan-style mukluks because I'm Yupik and I'm Athabascan, and I have a lot of the Yupik regalia already because growing up here on the Kuskokwim, and so there was a lot of the Athabascan stuff that I had to make. There's a lot of that I'm still doing, and I'm polishing my talent.
Leary's talent is skin sewing. She'll have 3 minutes to present it to judges.
I'll talk about the importance of it, you know, culturally, and why we do it and what it means, like your stitches and the types of materials that you use and just what it means to me to be passing this skill on and then, you know, teaching other people to do it, because it's something that's kind of dying off now that we can just go to the store and buy a pair of snow pants or a warm jacket.
Leary says she's raising money to fund her trip. Leary will compete in the Miss Indian World Cultural Pageant April 22nd through the 26th at the annual Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque. She's raising $3,000 to cover airfare, lodging, transportation, and other pageant expenses. She's raised over $1,000 as of Monday, April 14th. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Middle East exchange student Haitham Mohana and Juneau's Thunder Mountain High School Art Club presented an origami peacock of peace to the Alaska State Legislature on Monday. The peacock is made of more than 2,000 pieces of folded paper. Mohana says the peacock represents the dreams of the people from his home in Gaza.
I hope this peacock, which symbolizes the peace, go in each mind and each heart, and really raise our mind about the wars and conflicts.
Mohana is studying at Haines High School through an exchange program funded by the U.S. State Department. He learned how to make an origami peacock from a teacher in Gaza and taught the process to Thunder Mountain Art Club students while he was visiting Juneau. It took the club 3 months to fold more than 2,000 pieces of paper. The peacock is 3 feet wide and about 2 feet tall. Art Club coordinator Heather Ridgway says she didn't immediately know where the peacock should be displayed. She wanted it to be in a place where it could inspire people.
It was like, oh, of course, we'll take it to the Capitol. They are working on major issues that require everyone to commit time and attention and do a careful job and work together and be patient, just like making this peacock. Let's give it to the legislature.
Until a permanent place can be found for the origami peacock, it's temporarily displayed in the House Speaker's chambers. Like many hospitals in Southeast Alaska, Wrangell Medical Center is starting to look its age. A brand new hospital is still the long-term plan, but for now, the building is getting a much-needed makeover. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver took a tour of the facility with CEO Marla Sanger to see some of the renovations and updates.
Institutional. That's the word that best describes the old look of Wrangell Medical Center. The walls are a generically dreary tan, the banisters are scratched, the floors show the wear and tear of 1,000 muddy shoes scuffing up the walkway. It looks like a hospital.
It's utilitarian.
That's hospital CEO Marla Sanger. We're in the basement of the medical center, walking down a hallway to a positively tiny room. It's barely big enough to squeeze in some chairs and a desk and maybe a yoga mat.
But this area in here was the space where most of the physical therapy activity occurred. It has one window that looks out at a wall where a little bit of indirect light gets in. But other than that, it's very much just the kind of harsh lighting. It's got a gray carpet. There still was very excellent care provided here. But it is not an atmosphere that just says, you know, welcome, come in, you've come to the right place.
The hospital has struggled with its public image for the past couple of years, but it's making some major changes in how it relates to its patients and the community. And that's why Sanger says the time was right to freshen up the facility, too.
It's very treatment-like. I mean, it feels like, you feel like you've come here to have a treatment performed, where in the new physical therapy gym space, it feels to me much more like a health and wellness place, where people are coming in to achieve their optimal mobility and wellness. So we'll go take a look at that next.
The new physical therapy space is upstairs. It's a large room lined with mirrors. It's filled with brightly colored therapy balls and lots of equipment and exercise machines. The two rooms are like night and day, and this change happened in less than a month. Earlier this year, the entire physical therapy program was overhauled. The department was given 3 weeks to strip it down to the basics, reevaluate, and modernize.
And their task was to redesign this space, to design new processes for physical therapy, design all their documentation tools, design the way patients would get registered, the scheduling, everything. They identified pieces of equipment that we didn't have that they ordered, and then within from the time that they arrived until 3 weeks later, we went from what you saw downstairs to this new space.
And the problem with redoing one part of the hospital is that it underscores just how much the rest of the building needs a makeover too.
And I would kind of liken it to when you fix up a room of your house and then the rest of your house suddenly doesn't look so good. That feels kind of like what happened when we improved the physical therapy space and built the beautiful new gym. And then all of a sudden, we're looking at everything with kind of a bit askance. And so that's why we're doing this. It just needs to look better.
Sanger says she was strict with budgeting the renovations and shopped around carefully to get the most bang for the hospital's bucks. The result? The walls are getting a fresh coat of paint. Instead of the old peachy tan, they're sunny yellow on top and rich green on the bottom. The old worn banisters are getting refinished, and new carpets line the hallways. CEO Marla Sanger says that these renovations do not replace plans for a brand new facility.
Just because we're doing these improvements right now doesn't mean in any way that we're not still very interested and very much wanting a new hospital. And we are going to be continuing to try for that. It might be a bit difficult, but we're going to just try one step at a time and to get back on track, get it going again.
But in the meantime, she says, the hospital can continue to care for the community in a freshened up space with a brand new outlook. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
With all its public lands and scenic values, it's no surprise that Alaska has an advocacy organization for trails. The group, Alaska Trails, has statewide conferences every couple of years, and the next one starts April 24th at Alaska Pacific University. APRN's Steve Heimel tells us more.
You can start with this. There's never enough money. Participants in the Alaska Trails Conference will probably be greeted next week with the news that the $400,000 trail building and maintenance money they wanted in the capital budget did not survive the legislative session. Once again. But trail advocates are used to that, and this meeting will be about how to build alliances to make things happen. For instance, in and around Park City, Utah, there is now a huge network of trails.
We have really been lucky with that. We now brag about having almost 400 miles of public trails here, and that's in about a 100-square-mile area.
That's trail builder, designer, and consultant Troy Duffin, who gets partial credit for making much of that Park City trail network happen. Duffin's been a consultant on several Alaska jobs, including reconditioning the trails in Anchorage's Far North Bicentennial Park. He'll be a keynote speaker at the conference at APU discussing how to get local buy-in for trails, particularly property owners nervous about plans for upcoming trails.
it can be a very tough nut to get somebody to understand that a trail in close proximity to their home is a benefit, because if you're not used to it, the first blush is, well, I've heard everything, burglary and fire and personal crimes and voyeurism and anything you could imagine that the fears go through a homeowner or a property owner's mind right off the bat. But without fail, every time a trail has gone in that I'm aware of, property owners have just settled in and all those fears have dissipated, and whether they use it or love it or not, they at least are no longer afraid of it and do see it as a benefit.
Along with a healthy lifestyle, the benefit includes real money with increased property values and a quality of life valued by a young creative workforce, and hence the companies seeking to employ them. And a trail holds on to valued green space in a city. The city of Anchorage has already seen this. For Alaska Trails Executive Director Steve Cleary, the next task for Anchorage is to make the trails connect.
That's one of the most interesting questions for me as I look at the conference, is that interface between what I'll, just for ease of syntax, say urban and rural trails, or connecting cities to the trails or the trails back into the cities.
That's going in the right direction, right into the cities, says Troy Duffin.
It's a very challenging thing to do. But what we found is that most users really appreciate the opportunity to not have to, you know, put their bike or skis, you know, on or in the car, and to be able to access things directly from their homes. And while it can be very difficult to do in a lot of areas, it seems to be very worthwhile to put in that effort and to connect people that closely.
But how do you do that with little or no money? Duffin says in Park City, they figured out what the benefits of their trail network would be, then backed it up and went out and made their case to civic organizations and local governments.
We were able to work with them and help prove up the fact that tourists and other visitors to the area are more likely to get out and use the systems if there is a connecting trail close in. You know, they have to be able to see and touch and feel that. Then those groups, and I'm talking again about the Chamber, the Muni, and others, were willing to get behind it with support and funding. And then that led to the ability to offer up things to the reluctant private owners, which is typically money.
The money can then be used to purchase easements or corridors to make those last connections between the routes, an issue they call the last mile. And it turns out that Alaska's largest city does have some buy-in in the form of a live-work-play initiative that the civic groups have already signed on to. Next week's conference is open to public participation, and there's a free public talk next Friday by Olympic skier Holly Brooks right next to the trail she trains on. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Get away and stay in AK at UAS Juneau, small enough that your professors know you by name, big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new residence hall opening fall of 2014. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.